Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Emily Eakins. She's the director of polling at the Cato Institute, a position she also previously held at The Reason Foundation, the nonprofit that publishes this podcast. Emily also holds a PhD in political science from UCLA and writes on voter attitudes and millennial sentiments towards politics and culture. Emily Eakins, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, a recent analysis of the 2016 election results by the Voter Study Group at the Democracy Fund concluded that there were essentially no libertarian voters. And by that, they were kind of identifying it as people who were socially liberal and fiscally conservative. Instead, the study found that most voters fell into a liberal progressive camp that was liberal on economic issues and on identity issues, things like immigration, things like Muslim sentiments towards Muslims, gay marriage, things like that. But so it found that most voters fell into a liberal progressive camp, a populist group that was liberal on economics, but conservative on identity politics, and or conservative on identity issues and conservative on both economic and identity issues. And the conclusion was Trump won because he won conservatives and populists, while Hillary Clinton only pulled liberals. For me, and I suspect the big point of interest for you also was that the author, the political science scientist Lee Drutman, found that just 3.8% of voters fell into the libertarian group. There's a scatter plot. There's a very kind of lonely quadrant there that is supposedly where libertarians don't exist. It led to a lot of people talking about there is no libertarian vote. You know, we've been telling you this all along. Is Drutman right that there are essentially no libertarians in the electorate?
Well, first I'll say this, that I actually worked with Lee Drutman on this broader project. This is part of the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group. We fielded a very large longitudinal survey of 8,000 voters right after the election. And then several of us actually wrote up our own reports analyzing the data. So Lee wrote a paper, I wrote a paper, and I have a lot of respect for Lee Drutman and his research.
Okay, now stick the knife in. Okay, you have a lot of respect for him. And so while he's beaming and looking up at the sun.
But I would say that on this particular aspect of his paper where he says that there's only 3.8% libertarians, I would say that that is inconsistent with most all other academic research I have ever seen on the subject. He also found that about 45% of the public fell into this, you know, kind of economically liberal and socially liberal or identity liberal quadrant. Again, I've never seen anything that high in the literature, and I've surveyed, you know, most all of it that's really looked at this question. So I would just say it's very inconsistent, and so you kind of want to know, well, what's going on? And I think what happens is that people use different methods to try to identify the number of liberals, libertarians, conservatives, and populists. They use different methods. They also use different definitions. You know, what does it mean to be a liberal or a libertarian? And then also the method that the questions that they use to try to ascertain if you are a libertarian also differ. And so in this instance, you know, one of the dimensions you said that so typically when we try to identify libertarians, we look at people who are, you know, economically, well, some will call it economically conservative, or others will say less government intervention in the economy, and then socially liberal. That's not exactly how his methodology worked. That second dimension wasn't really about like gay marriage and legalization of marijuana, you know, those types of social issues. It was about identity, and he used a battery of questions that are very commonly used in academia, but they're very controversial, and they're used to determine your attitudes towards African Americans and racial minorities. And so these questions are kind of problematic, and I think that's part of the problem. And I could give you one example. One of the questions, it's kind of an annoying question. It should put off most people, but the question goes something like this: do you agree or disagree with the following statement? The Irish, the Italians, the Jews overcame prejudice without any special favors. African Americans should do the same. And I think most people who hear this just think, oh, why are we, you know, talking about groups? You know, we're individuals, right? But the problem is if someone believes that, you know, no one should get special favors, then they're going to probably agree with that statement. However, if you agree with that statement, you're coded as racist or, you know, not in the liberal direction, shall we say.
Right. Would you end up as a conservative or a populist?
So those people are probably going to get pushed into the conservative populist buckets. And so essentially, if you were to be a libertarian with this analysis, you would want less government spending, you know, lower taxes, less government involvement in healthcare, but also want government to, quote, give special favors. You know, it's just a very bizarre combination of attitudes that I'm unfamiliar with in the literature.
Well, that it reminds me of, I know in the old Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory, which is still used in various ways. But back in the 40s and 50s, if you were a woman, like among the questions they would ask would be like, do you like reading Popular Mechanics or do you like working with tools? And if you said yes, you would be kicked over into a lesbian category because, you know, that was obvious signs of, you know, that there was something not right with you. So, I mean, what you're saying then is that, you know, more than in many things, you really need to look at the way in which the models are built and executed to figure out, because different researchers have different definitions. I know in your work, or you've written recently at the Cato website at cato.org about how typically libertarians come up as about 10% to 20% of the electorate, and that the wider range is 7% to 22%. And the fact that somebody comes up with a new and novel finding isn't, it doesn't mean they're wrong, but it means you really pay attention to see what's going on. But how do most studies define libertarians? And do you find that is the 10% to 20% any more accurate than, you know, the 3.8%?
Well, so I looked at the literature, the academic literature on the subject about how do we identify these groups. And there's different methods that are used. You know, one simple method, but I would say not as good of a method, is just ask people to identify themselves. A lot of people don't know they're libertarian when they are, and a lot of people think they're libertarian when maybe they're not. So that's not the best method. But if you do that, you get about 11% or so who will self-identify as libertarian on a survey. But a better method that academics often use is very similar to what Drutman used in his paper, which is to ask people a series of public policy questions on a variety of different issues. Now, then the next step is where you can diverge. I would say the gold standard from there is to do a type of statistical procedure called a cluster analysis, where you allow a statistical algorithm to take the inputs of those questions and identify, you know, a good solution about how many clusters of people are there in the electorate. And Stanley Feldman and Christopher Johnson did exactly this. I would say this is probably the gold standard. And what they found was 15% were libertarian, and they defined that as that they tended to give conservative answers on economic questions or the role of government in the economy, and gave more liberal responses on social and cultural issues. So that's a very common way to do it. They found 17% were conservative, so not much different than libertarians. Slightly more were liberal, meaning economically liberal and socially liberal, 23%. And then they found about 8% were populists. Now, that's not 100%. They found two other groups of people as well, which I think also kind of speaks to how interesting their analysis was. They found these two groups really didn't have strong opinions on economics, but they differed on whether they leaned socially liberal or socially conservative. And that actually, I think, tells us a lot. It fits well with what we see in American politics, is that there are a lot of people out there that really don't know much about how the economy works, but they do have an opinion when it comes to social and cultural policy.
How does this sort of kind of these typologies of voters, how does it square with somebody like the political science Maurice Fiorina, who has for a couple of decades at least has been arguing that When we talk about culture war in America, and by that he means, you know, polarized politics, and he grants that politics is very polarized and it's getting more polarized, partly because the nominating processes for candidates that run for public office are typically in the hands of the most kind of ideologically or dogmatically extreme members of various parties. But he says, you know, when you look at a broad variety of issues, whether it's things like abortion, whether it's drug legalization, whether it is immigration, that there's oftentimes there's a broad 60% or more kind of agreement or consensus, so that we're actually one of the things he says is that, our differences are routinely exaggerated and our agreements are typically ignored. Does that make sense how does that match up with what you're talking about here? Because most people who do voter analyses talk about the things that separate voters rather than the commonality.
Right. It actually is very consistent with what the data suggests. And also, if you're to look at my post at cato.org, the first chart in the post, I graphically display kind of where the people live. Where are the libertarians and the conservatives and the liberals? If you were to plot them in an ideological plane, like the Nolan chart, on economic issues.
Yeah, that's the world's smallest political quiz, right? And it's essentially a diamond shape that is made into quadrants, and you're either more libertarian or more authoritarian from top to bottom. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the same idea. And what I did in this graph is plot where all the people live ideologically. And what you see is it's a big blob. There is no structure, meaning there aren't just these two. So the story of polarization, which does seem to be true at the congressional level, people who are elected to political office, but of the regular people of America, if polarization were happening and if Mo Fiorino were wrong, then you would just see these two groups of people separated from each other on this plane. But that's not what it is. We see people are just randomly distributed, meaning there are people with all different types of combinations of attitudes. And the way our politics actually manifests is how we organize those people into, how those people organize themselves, I should say, into interest groups, into advocacy organizations, into businesses, and then ultimately into politics. So, the way it is now with, Democrats and Republicans, it's by no means the only kind of organization of politics that we could have.
Is there a sense, and certainly I feel this, and Matt Welch, my recent colleague, and I have written a book about it, but that, part of what we're witnessing in, and it's hard to believe we're in the 2017, we're well into the 21st century, but we're kind of stuck with these two large political groupings, that go back to before the Civil War, and that the groups that they were originally, and they get remade every couple of decades, but the groups, the kind of conglomeration of voting interests that they once served, say even in the 70s or 80s, have kind of fallen apart because to go from your kind of blob on the Nolan chart to Democrats and Republicans in Congress, it's if you're pro-abortion, you have to vote for a Democrat, and if you vote for a Democrat, that means you're also voting in favor of certain elements of affirmative action or immigration policy. If you're a Republican and you don't want people to burn the flag, it also means you have to be for lower marginal tax rates. And these are things that really don't have any necessary connection. And is it that that the parties are describing or they're appealing to fewer and fewer people, but you still have to vote for one or the other?
Yes, and that's probably contributed to the rise of the independent voter, as you well documented in your book. Political scientists have shown that it's not just unique to the U.S., but most countries that have a political system similar to ours have what is equivalent to their Congress or their Parliament divided along economic issues. So in the United States, this is by no means always true, but typically speaking, when people vote, they tend to vote along their economic interests or their economic issue positions, if that makes any sense. and all the social issues, or at one time race became a second dimension in American politics, you know, when these other issues have come out, then, you know, people are kind of stuck where if they are out of alignment with their party on maybe social issues, but are in alignment on economics, you know, the forces tend to have them voting along the lines of economics. And that seems to be true, not just in the U.S., but other countries.
And that seems to, I mean, that kind of explains libertarians voting, oftentimes self-identified libertarians or people in the libertarian movement aligning with the Republican Party rather than the Democratic Party. Because, yeah, I mean, most of the people I suspect most of the people I talk to that I know at Cato and certainly at Reason are kind of askance. You know, they're not happy with Republican positions on a variety of science issues, on a variety of social issues, for sure. But they end up voting because they say, you know, economics is more important.
Yes, that seems to be what happens. But I mean, to some extent, that is changing. There are periods of time where another dimension rises up, like racial issues in the 60s. Civil rights became so important that some people were willing to say, I am not going to stand with this party and allow it to continue doing what it's doing. And it forced the parties to change.
So how does immigration fit into this? Because in Drutman's analysis, it seems that immigration is a big, you know, is one of those kind of inflection points or hot spots. And it becomes very interesting to me. Because, you know, Hillary Clinton, when she was running as senator for the Senate in New York, was very explicitly anti-illegal immigrants. She said she was against giving them driver's license. Bill Clinton forced the Democratic Party platform in the 90s to be very hostile to immigration in general, but especially illegals. And one of the big pieces of legislation that he signed, actually, welfare reform in the 90s, and this is not necessarily a bad thing, but made it illegal immigrants and even legal immigrants for the first 5 years to be cut off from transfer payments, means tested transfer payments. So, you know, there's a sense that the Democrats are friendlier towards immigrants than Republicans. And there seems to be some evidence for that, at least in attitudes, if not in policy, because Obama was pretty terrible towards immigrants. But Mitt Romney was even worse. My larger question, or I guess there's two questions here. One is something like immigration. It's not exactly clear how different the parties are in practice. But then it's also like, how much does it matter to voters whether or not they might feel very strongly about immigration, but it might be the 10th issue that they actually vote on, so that, you know, it doesn't even really come into play. How do you measure the intensity of a voter's belief in a particular topic and how that actually influences who they pull the lever for?
Okay, so there's a lot there. I think the first thing I would say is that there is a lot of posturing when it comes to immigration policy. Like you said, in many ways, there aren't significant differences between many Republican and Democratic lawmakers when they talk about or when they in their actual positions on immigration, but their posturing is different. You know, talking about self-deportation, that immigrants must learn English. Now, again, it's not to say most Americans, to be honest, would prefer immigrants learn English. It's not like that is so controversial. It's the way that it is said, right? So if your very first thing is about we need to secure the border, and then second, then we need to deal with X, Y, and Z immigration issue, it gives the impression to people who are themselves immigrants or their children or, you know, friends of immigrants, they're close to the immigrant experience, they get the very strong impression that they are not welcome. And that is hugely important in how people are voting. And that's why Democrats appear to be the kind of the pro-immigration party more so than Republicans. There are some policy differences like DACA and things like that. But posturing is hugely important. Now, generally speaking, I would say immigration hasn't been, you know, the highest priority when it comes to how people vote. But data coming out of the 2016 election that I find very compelling and that we worked on as part of the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group suggests that immigration attitudes were by far what made this election and voting for Donald Trump most distinctive. And it's not to say that people changed their minds. They don't seem to have changed their minds, but rather these were concerns that they already had and they were activated by the rhetoric of the campaign. So these were concerns people had. Most Republicans and Democrats weren't talking about it in a way that people could really relate to. then Trump comes in and just blows the lid off of it without nuance or without sophistication about kind of the delicate issues that are at play here. And people were so kind of relieved and validated to have someone talk about immigration in the ways that they thought of it. They became very devoted to him. I was just going to say, and that meant other scandals that came out during the course of the campaign did not matter as long as he continued to validate feelings on immigration.
And in the Drubman analysis, I mean, part of it was that, you know, he sees the Democratic Party as basically pretty supportive and in line behind liberal economic policies and liberal identity policies. He identifies two different groups within the Republican Party that Trump appealed to. And one are traditional conservatives and Republican voters who are conservative on social issues and also say they're conservative on economic issues, but then populists. And I guess populists he defines as people who are into kind of big government. Populists like farm subsidies. They like business subsidies. They like subsidies for jobs and the idea that the government will take care of them against the you know, whether it's Islamic terrorists or big business or rapacious interests, but they're conservative on these identity issues. So Trump, in a way, I guess, in that reading, he was able to get the populace who might have voted for Obama in 2012, but definitely were not going to vote for Hillary because she seemed to be, you know, she's part of the establishment. She doesn't care about them. She's a New York elitist. Is that accurate?
I think that is. You know, Obama had an economic message that resonated with these voters. Hillary Clinton didn't seem to give the impression that she cared much about them at all. She thought, demography is destiny. We no longer need voters that come from certain kind of economic and, you know, just other types of strata in the electorate. And she didn't talk to them. Obama did. And it served him well.
Yeah, I mean, the joke was that she had she went to Chipotle more often during the 2016 campaign than Wisconsin. And you assume if you're a displaced or you feel like you're a displaced factory worker in northern Wisconsin and somebody's gone to Chipotle, you're not going to identify with them particularly strongly.
Yes, that's true. And also, you know, a lot of people had argued that Donald Trump is basically a Democrat. I mean, he was for years, right? And he gave lots of money to Democrats. He's basically a Democrat, but he is very suspicious of immigration, which is right now out of line with the Democratic Party.
Right. And he ran against the swamp in D.C. and all the people who had been living there or attached to it for years, even though his economic policies were indistinguishable. It's just in the news that the Carrier air conditioning plant in Indiana that he had, you know, made a big stink about, you know, getting them to not move to Mexico. And of course, all the jobs are going to Mexico anyway. But it was a very kind of interventionist. I don't even know that it's Democrat versus Republican, because Republicans love business subsidies in their own way. But it was very populist, certainly, that the president was going to force big business to heal and to, you know, kind of do what is right for the common American worker. Well, let's your Cato colleague, David Bowes, who has written widely and wonderfully about libertarianism, and you've done some work with him. About a year ago, he asked Gallup to follow up. And I'm curious about this because I like this story a lot. But he used Gallup data to kind of break people into four categories: conservatives, liberals, populists, and libertarians. And he found, using a question that keyed off of that Gallup itself uses to kind of talk about political ideology, he found that libertarians, people who tended to be socially tolerant and in favor of small government, were the single largest ideological bloc at 27%. Then there were conservatives at 26%, liberals at, I think it was 23%, and populists at 15%. Does that work for you in general, that method and those results? Do you find those are worth kind of keeping in the front of our minds?
Well, I would say that's a little bit on the higher end of the numbers that I've seen, but that's, you know, a product of the method of using, I believe, they were using two questions, right? Something on an economic issue, you know, role of government in the economy, and then traditional values. And you just kind of look at who of the respondents said that they wanted small government and government not to promote traditional values. And, you know, that's a fine way to kind of quickly segment the electorate. But I probably wouldn't put too much stock in there being a difference between 27% and 23%. I do think, though, that populist, the populist bucket, if you will, Paul Krugman called them hard hats. Some people call them communitarians or statists. They do seem to be a smaller segment of the electorate, and I think that they're going to be getting smaller as people do become kind of more socially liberal over time.
Is there a sense, and I realize this might be outside of your realm of expertise or interest, but part of the thing is that for as mediocre as the economy has been in the entire 21st century, we've been well below 2% annual growth, which, was something we used to take for granted, or even something closer to 3%. But the fact is that, like, most people's material lives are pretty good and they're getting better in terms of, people have food, clothing, and shelter, and those things tend to get better over time. Are we moving more into a realm where the more kind of symbolic issues, or what you talked about as posturing, or what we might call identity issues, are those going to dominate more and more? You had mentioned that civil rights was a huge factor in the 60s. Obviously, there was foreign policy as well as economic issues going on. But are we more in a symbolic space now where it's not about, whether or not people have enough to eat? Nobody's going to win election as president again by promising a chicken in every pot. But are we in a kind of post-economic phase of political identity?
I think that's a very interesting question. It reminds me of Brink Lindsey's book, Age of Abundance, with the idea being that economic wealth essentially allows us to have, I'll just kind of make this up here, luxury ideological goods. So if you're not, if you have what you need, then you can focus on other things that you believe in truly from a political standpoint, but that are not kind of related to the bread and butter of, jobs, housing, food, things like that. And certainly we have seen that kind of the introduction of social issues and cultural issues as being kind of a second dimension of American politics emerged about the time that, economic prosperity and growth really took off. But I would say this as kind of a caveat to that. In the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group that we worked, our group more broadly, two authors, Rui Teixeira and Robert Griffin at the Center for American Progress, they did another paper. And what they found was, I thought, very interesting, that individuals who were struggling economically or said they were struggling economically in 2012 were significantly more likely by 2016 to have become more anxious and concerned about immigration and wanting to restrict immigration. So let me just, if I'm saying that clearly enough here. So people that had worse economic situations in 2012, 4 years later, disproportionately turned against immigration. Why is that? It does seem to me that there, to some extent, this isn't just purely kind of an ideological kind of luxury issue, that many people perceive it to be economic, even if it might not be, people think it is.
Right. And it speaks to a whole host of kind of, beyond any question about economics. And I, as good libertarians, I suspect we agree that even illegal, or maybe especially illegal, immigrants are a boon to the economy, to the culture, et cetera. But regardless of the economics of it, the idea that you are a person in America who has been kind of made redundant or irrelevant in a particular economic moment, and you're pissed. And immigrants are the ultimate kind of place where you can focus your anger and ire. Somehow they are getting something that you cannot anymore.
Right. There definitely seems to be something going on there. And it was something, it was a theory that a lot of people had, but I think Teixeira and Griffin really showed that empirically.
It's now, of course, Teixeira also has been talking about the oncoming ironclad Democratic majority for decades, really. And we all do this, right? Where going back to Kevin, who was the Kevin Phillips, who had, the coming Republican majority at a point when the Republicans looked like they were about to go out of business. And he was right for a while, then was wrong, right again. What You know, one of the things that Gallup and I guess Harris used to do this too, where they would ask people to self-identify both as Republican and Democrat. And it was always that there were always more Democrats, people who would identify as Democrats than Republicans. But there were always many more people who would identify as conservatives rather than liberal. And in most of those things, the self-identified liberal group would never really get more than about 20% of the electorate going back to 1970. And conservatives would be in the 40s, you know, sometimes almost at the 50s. And yet, over the past half century, Republicans, you know, keep winning elections, particularly at the state and local level, and Democrats keep losing. What, you know, is there any worthwhile way of kind of digging through that, where there are more Democrat people who identify as Democrats, but there are more conservatives, but you know, and so that's why Republicans win elections? Or is this just, these are categories that are so loose that they really don't tell us anything?
Well, I mean, I think the first point, you know, it brought to mind a phrase that I think you hear a lot of people say, where they say, I'm a conservative, I'm not a Republican. You know, that distinction matters to a lot of people. But as political science research has shown, over time, the parties have become more aligned with a particular ideology. So conservatives are more likely to be Republican and liberals more likely to be Democrats than in the past. That doesn't mean, though, that people are comfortable with the word liberal. For some reason, the word liberal has been kind of a bad word. And so a lot of people who really are, you know, just liberal Democrats would say, oh, I'm a moderate Democrat, or, you know, I'm more conservative. So that's just more semantics. I think that's why we want to ask them, what do they think about public policy? That's the best way to know kind of where people go. I don't know how this maps onto, though, the fact that Republicans have been doing better at winning these state and local elections, other than the idea that they are more organized than the Democrats are right now. And right now, Democrats seem to be very focused at the federal level and protests, and more like expressing themselves. So, for instance, in Los Angeles, it's my understanding that wasn't there like 700,000 people who turned out for the Women's March, and it was, you know, only a couple hundred thousand showed up for the local elections in LA in the same month. Yes. Yeah, so right now it seems like Democrats are more focused on expressing frustration and anger, and Republicans have been more organized. And as a result, they have been winning more elections at the state and local levels.
Let's talk about millennials. You did a few years ago, you did a fantastic survey for Reason and the Roop Foundation about millennials, and you've continued to work that ground. Are millennials, you know, are they more or less libertarian than Gen Xers or baby boomers? Is there, you foregrounded a lot of this, and I guess we actually wrote something together about this that I'm now in my dotage I'm remembering. But, you know, it seems that millennials use a different language to talk about politics. But are they, you know, and a lot of people confuse that for them being, you know, socialists, literally socialists. A lot of millennials love Bernie Sanders. Millennials, at least going back to the Obama years, which would have been the first elections that they could have voted in, you know, overwhelmingly vote for Democrats at the presidential level. So what, you know, what's your take on millennials? Are they more or less libertarian than people in the past? Are they more or less liberal or progressive?
It's hard to answer that question. I would say that Gen X, in some respects, seems to be maybe the more libertarian generation of the groups. With millennials, what we found is that they don't seem to stand out on economic policy. So a lot of people think that they're all socialists because they like Bernie Sanders. It actually doesn't seem to line up with where the facts are, but they came of a political age, more or less, when Bush was either president or on his way out, and the Republican Party brand was in shambles, and Obama, you know, it was an incredibly popular brand and figure. And so obviously the messengers that they trust, you know, President Obama, Jon Stewart at The Daily Show, the messengers that they trusted really didn't tell them anything about free market economics. So it's actually maybe almost surprising that they're not more statist than they are. It's on the social issues that we see a difference, and that they are more kind of more libertarian on social issues and civil liberties, except for one issue. free speech issues, I think this is something that we're going to need to keep an eye on, where younger people are more supportive of the idea that some sort of authority, whether it's the college administrator or the government, should limit certain speech that is considered offensive or insulting to people.
Wow. And you're working on a study about that. Is that correct?
That's correct. It should be out in September.
Wow. That is obviously something to look forward to. You also recently identified in at Cato.org, five types of Trump voters. What are they and how are they relevant to kind of analysis? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So this is also part of the Democracy Fund Voter Study Group. We've talked about them quite a bit during this podcast. So I wrote a separate paper that did a type of statistical analysis, a cluster analysis of the Trump voters, because a lot of folks have kind of had this tendency to talk about the Trump voter as though it's one type of person that voted for him for one particular reason. But this statistical analysis that I ran found five different types of Trump voters. And they are very different from one another on even the issues central to the campaign, immigration, matters of race and American identity. They're even very different on the size and scope of government. So in a way, it's kind of amazing that they're all in one coalition here. But I could go over some of those groups if you are interested.
Yes, please do.
Yes. So the first group I'll mention, I call them the American preservationists. They are the core Trump coalition that put him through the primaries. They're not the most loyal Republican voters, though. They're more economically progressive. They're very concerned about Medicare. They want to tax the wealthy some more. But they are very, very suspicious of immigration, both legal and illegal. And they have cooler feelings towards racial minorities and immigrants. And so they kind of fit the more the typical media accounts of Trump voters. And what really surprised me about this group is that they were the only group that really felt this way and the most likely group to think that being of European descent was important for being truly American. So a very unusual group of voters, but they comprised about 20% of the whole coalition.
Wow. And they're highly motivated and intensely active. I recognize them daily in the comment section at Reason.
Yes. So, but again, 20% of the coalition. There was another group that I think would really surprise you that existed in the same coalition. I call them the free marketeers. They actually comprised a larger share, 25%, and in many ways, they're the polar opposite of the American preservationists. They were the most hesitant Trump group. Most of them voted for Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio in the primaries, and they said that really their vote was against Hillary Clinton, as opposed being for Trump. And these are just, as the name implies, small government, fiscal conservatives. They have very warm feelings towards immigrants and racial minorities. They're the most likely group to support making it easier to legally immigrate to the U.S. They're very similar to Democrats on kind of these identity issues. So they're kind of just polar opposites of the preservationists.
How do they, and I guess I know the answer to this, which is it's Hillary Clinton, but I mean, because Trump was so out there in terms of trade protectionism and, forcing businesses to his will. I mean, he did not seem to be at all a free trader or a free marketer.
Not at all, but Hillary Clinton, besides trade, didn't seem to be one either. And since they disliked her so much, it seems like, that's why they voted for Trump. Now, but they also have the most in common with the third party voters who voted for Gary Johnson. So if they weren't voting for Johnson or staying home, they were in this bucket.
You did have one group in your schematic that were, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the title now, but it was like the disinterested or disaffected voters. Is that right?
Yes, they were a small group, the disengaged, and they didn't tell us much about their politics. They're the type of people that when they take surveys, they just don't have many opinions. But the opinions that they did have were they were suspicious of immigration and they felt the system was rigged against them. And that was really kind of a more common thread. It's not a thread that all the Trump voters shared in common, but there was a bit more suspicion of immigration, which makes sense because that was a major part of Trump's campaign rhetoric.
Right. Well, and that also calls to mind the Drutman analysis, where the idea, this idea of the system being rigged or the system not working anymore, if not, the, you know, the system is either actively hostile to you or it just is totally incompetent in delivering basic things like, you know, I work hard, so I should have a good life. The system isn't doing that anymore. Is that, you know, which also linked Trump and Bernie Sanders, because Sanders was running as an outsider in oftentimes in terms that were almost indistinguishable from Trump. Is that really kind of the battleground now of whether or not you are working, you know, are you supporting the establishment or are you a marker of the system or are you actively attacking it? Is that kind of the real front of American politics?
I don't quite see it like that. Now, I did find a group that fits that exactly, and their name is just what you'd expect. I call them the anti-elites, and they fit just what you're talking about. They don't really align with Trump that much on immigration issues. They're a lot like Democrats on economics and immigration, but they really felt like the system was, you know, rigged against ordinary people like themselves and kind of the establishment versus kind of the people. But, you know, for two of the five clusters, and they were they're the majority of the Trump voters, like, you know, the free marketeers and another group that I haven't mentioned yet, the staunch conservatives, they're just more conventional Republicans. They don't think the system is rigged. They don't think that people take advantage of you. They think that they have agency and that they, through their votes, can change the political process, which is the exact opposite of the preservationists that I mentioned and the anti-elites, which fits that narrative that you're talking about. Now, that narrative really does a good job at explaining more of the vote switchers, the people who voted for Obama in 2012 and switched to Trump in 2016. They do feel that way. But it doesn't explain all of the Trump voters.
How common was it for people to have voted for Obama and then to have switched to Trump?
I had the number just to, almost in the top of my head. Maybe about like 6%, something like that. Sizable enough, obviously. But there were also voters, Republicans who had voted for Romney, who switched and voted for Hillary Clinton or a third party. And if I remember correctly, it was slightly more Obama voters switched to Trump than Romney voters that left the Republican Party. So there's a slight net gain, but I think that's important for people to realize that for all the voters that Trump picked up, the Republican Party lost a lot of voters too because of Trump.
Do we make a mistake, a kind of fundamental mistake, when we try to analyze political trends through presidential elections? Because, you know, they come once every 4 years. We had, you know, this time around, we had the two least liked candidates in American history. Is it a problem if we key too much off of who wins the presidency? And we essentially, just as we started the 21st century with a dead heat where, you know, a few thousand votes essentially separated Bush and Gore, you know, we had this bizarre outcome where Trump lost the popular vote pretty sizably, but won the electoral vote. And, you know, to my mind, that's not a constitutional crisis. It's a sign that nobody can get to 50%. You know, is it wrong to look at the presidential races as the way, you know, to tell us where politics is going?
Now, I think you're absolutely right. People read way too much into presidential elections. If you recall, after George W. Bush won in 2004, there were all sorts of kind of magazine covers and books that would show America, like, you know, red America being huge and then blue America, the coast being, you know, really small and kind of the permanent Republican majority. But then, you know, then Obama won and then it was, you know, demographics is destiny and it's going to be the permanent Democratic majority. And even still, a lot of people have read, particularly I would say on the more Republican side of thing, have read too much into this Trump election, thinking like, oh, you know, if only Republicans, you know, kind of appeal in the way that Trump does, that's how they win. So here's what we know in political science. This might surprise some of the listeners here, but that economic variables, for instance, how fast the economy is growing, what is the labor force participation rate, as well as the current president's approval ratings, you know, a couple of these structural variables predict almost every election outcome over the past 100 years. And what that means is, I'm not saying campaigns don't matter. They seem to have to matter in some respect. Like, maybe if you didn't run a campaign, then you would just get blown out of the water. But assuming you've got two campaigns going, the structural variables seem to be hugely important. They're not always right. They've missed three elections. One of them was Gore versus Bush. As you recall, Gore did, you know, technically win the popular vote. So these models seem to be pretty good. And throughout this entire election campaign, I was telling folks, hey, look at, I'm forgetting his name, excuse me. There's a few economists that do this. Alan Abramowitz did one of these models. Ray Fair at Princeton does a model. If you followed Ray Fair's model, he predicted a Republican win almost the entire election. So I thought, well, just about any Republican can win this election. I thought Trump might not be able to do that. There are outliers, but he did pull it out. And I think part of the reason are these economic fundamentals.
Well, let's close out by talking about libertarians and their way forward. For people who are libertarian voters, you know, obviously Gary Johnson and William Weld, for all of the, you know, kind of tension and controversies within that campaign and whatnot, they had the best, by far the best results of any Libertarian Party candidate. But beyond, you know, the LP with small L libertarians, what are the issues that libertarians are interested in that seem to give the most possibility of meaningful building meaningful alliances and pushing forward over the next couple of years? You know, in the past, you know, it's been things like drug legalization, criminal justice reform, certain aspects of immigration and free trade, certainly gender equality and marriage equality. But what are libertarians? Where would you say, given their kind of array of issues, where do those match up with most other groups where we might be able to build meaningful alliances?
I think it's a great question, but I think it's a hard question to really answer. I agree with you, most of those issues, that those continue to be kind of key issues for libertarians, particularly criminal justice reform, privacy issues. That's something that really wasn't on the radar in terms of issues until, you know, Edward Snowden, really, it seems like. But I think another thing for libertarians to think about is thinking about Republicans and Democrats and realizing that they do have shared interests with both groups, and to try to emphasize what we as libertarians are for, not what we're against. And so I'll give you an example, because we're talking about healthcare a lot in the news. I am for everyone who wants to have access to health care to be able to get it. I mean, we live in a country where, like, people have houses, they have access to food, and they don't have the government running it, right? We have found a way that the markets provide these things, and then we do have a social safety net for those who hit hard times and need help. We have ways to fill those gaps, but that doesn't require the government to run it all, right? So when it comes to things like health care and other issues like that, we are for all these positive outcomes. The question is, what's the best way to do it? And what I often hear is some of our libertarian friends talking about what we're against. So let's talk about what we're for, whether that be for criminal justice reform, whether it be for health care, whether that be for entitlement reform, drug reform, and so forth. Let's talk about the end goals. Because you think about it, I hear this coming from the political parties all the time. They tell you the outcome that they want to deliver you. Now, they're wrong all the time. But let's talk about the outcomes that we believe that a freer society, that libertarian public policy can help deliver. Let's focus on the positive.
All right. Well, that sounds like pretty sage advice. And I'll be very interested in September when your paper about free speech on and millennials comes out, because it may be, it'll be interesting to see what's the outcome you're proffering there, and then working to persuade millennials who are more likely to believe in constraints on speech. It sounds like a tough nut to crack, but a really interesting one as well. Well, we have been talking with Emily Eakin. She's the director of polling at the Cato Institute, and she is also a PhD in political science from UCLA and writes widely on voter attitudes and millennial attitudes as well. Emily, thanks so much for joining the Reason podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And for Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.